Various fishermen from the Cordova and area of Prince William Sound have been very active, to say the least, in pressing questions to the Exxon and Coast Guard representatives. Having gathered their information, the fishermen have now felt that they have a position and some concerns, and have chosen to host their own press conference to make those concerns known. We'll be broadcasting this live starting at 8:10. We're anticipating our morning situation briefing from the Coast Guard at 9 o'clock, and at this point Exxon has an 11 o'clock press conference scheduled, so it should be a busy morning from with our remote unit here at the Civic Center. For the time being, though, we are waiting for the start of the press conference. Should be in another 10 minutes, or rather 8 minutes or so now. So until we do come back for the beginning of that conference, we'll go back to the studio. Thank you, James.
And this is KCHU, listener-supported radio for Valdez, Cordova, and around Prince William Sound. Until then.
This is Dave Hammack from the Valdez Civic Center. Jack Lamb of CDFU is beginning the press conference by CDFU and UFA.
And before we begin going into what we have to say, each of us, there's a couple of little announcements I'd like to make. First off is that tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. in Cordova, there will be a town meeting. Cordova has got the largest concentration of fishing-related people on site that live there year-round that are totally involved in the fishery, and they feel very strongly about what's happening here. And there will be a town meeting taking place tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock in that community. You can find out the where and whys by calling 424-3447 or 7473. Either of those numbers will provide you with information as to where the meeting will take place. Also, we'd like to let you know that if any of you have a desire for to review the things that we were talking about individually, that we will be making copies of our the things that we're going to be talking about. They will be made available to you at 11 o'clock this morning. At this particular time, I'd like to say that each of the people up here on the platform with me is a member of the fishing community in Prince William Sound. This oil spill disaster affects each one of us. Each of us will be speaking from a little different point of view. Hopefully that we will provide a basis for your questions that we would ask that you would hold until we all have had an opportunity to speak, at which time you can address any one of us or select a question, and whichever person would be able to handle it will speak to that question. At this particular time, I'm going to do just kind of a brief summary of things leading up to our presentation, or leading up to us here. That's what my talk is basically about. I'm going to start from the very beginning, because at 7 o'clock on Friday morning is when we first found out that we had an oil spill in Prince William Sound. It was at that time that we were made aware that the Exxon Valdez was hard aground on Bligh Reef. The immediate response in Cordova was, from our office, was that we began gathering a list of names of fishermen who had vessels in the water or could easily be put in the water, prepared to respond to assist in any manner at any time. And by 9 o'clock in the morning, that effort had been accomplished. We had nearly 30 vessels fueled and ready to go at anybody's request at any time. At that time also, we began, at 9 o'clock, we began to make our presence and our readiness aware. We tried to make our readiness available and known to Alyeska, to the response team, to anybody else that we could get a hold of that we felt would be connected with this, so that they would know that they had at least that many vessels ready and willing to go to work to assist in any manner. Volunteer effort. That was what we did. We had that readiness and we continued throughout the day. Several of our members of the fishing community are also pilots, and those pilots took men with them, overflew the spill site with video cameras, and throughout the day up until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, as a result of these videos, we documented on a chart in our office the spread of the spill until about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Approximately that time in the afternoon, one of the people from Tetitlik, the village of Tetitlik, directly out here, almost next door, well, next door to the spill site, gave us a call in the office there to see what kind of contact we had had, who had communicated with us, and no one had at that time. They said that they had also gathered together 15 vessels at Tetitlik, both larger vessels, skiffs, whatever was necessary that they had available, and made Alyeska and the people in the response team aware that this was available also, and they were wondering why they hadn't been contacted. We continued on through the evening listening to the to the press conference that took place, the governor's press conference that took place that night. We continued to just come monitor things until way late in the night. We had conversations and phone calls until 2 o'clock in the morning. The next morning, back in the office again, seeing what was taking place, we felt that it was important that I join Ricky Ott over here. She had flown over to begin with at the very beginning of the spill on Friday morning. And at approximately 10 a.m., I boarded an aircraft to come to Valdez. In coming to Valdez, I overflew the site, not directly because we didn't want to get inside of the restricted zone there, but flew across the top of Bly Island at approximately 2,900 feet to observe what was taking place at that time, which was approximately 10:30 on Saturday morning. It appeared that the only thing that was taking place was that the tanker, the Baton Rouge, had maneuvered to be alongside of the Exxon Valdez. There was one boom trailing downstream in a straight line from that juncture of vessels there, and congregated around Bly Reef buoy were several other smaller vessels that I could not identify. That was the extent of what was going on out there at that particular time. At this time, this was at 10:30 on Saturday morning, and from the time that the designated grounding took place, that means that approximately 34 and a half hours had passed. At that time, arriving at Valdez, we began to ask, what's going on? What happened? Where was the response team that was supposed to be there in 5 hours? We began to see other questions as we got here. How'd the tanker wind up on that reef? How on earth did he get so far out of his designated tanker lane? Why was there no radar contact? It's our understanding that at that particular time that a radar contact was apparently available. This was our understanding, that it was available out beyond that particular point. Why weren't they being monitored? Why were there no radio warnings to the vessel that they were so far out of their designated traffic lane? These are all questions that came to mind. Then it got down a little more critically, who on earth is responsible for this? And probably the biggest question, not probably, undoubtedly the biggest question that began to surface in everybody's mind is, what happens to our industry in Prince William Sound? The backbone of the industry in Prince William Sound that supports the economy of the Sound. That's where we're at, and that's where we're still at. Each individual that will come up now and speak will identify themselves and their relationship to the fishery. I'm going to step down, but I would ask again that you would allow each one to speak before asking in-depth questions. Thank you.
Jack Lamb, Vice President of CDFU, has been speaking, and now the second of...
Good morning. My name is David Grimes. I'm a commercial herring and salmon fisherman here in the Sound. And I'm going to try to address a few historical issues here, try to put things in perspective. But first, I wanted to take a couple moments to say some things from the heart. In my mind, Prince William Sound isn't just any body of water. It's probably the finest marine area in North America. And it's certainly one of the crown jewels on the in the world's remaining pristine ecosystem. So we've hit right at the heart here. You hit at my heart. A lot of my friends are walking around sort of shell-shocked as if they'd lost a son or daughter. There's a sense of violation of your home and certainly a loss of innocence. So it's interesting to be here. We'll start on to history here. We'll start our chronology with the year 1778, when Bly Island Reef received its name from William Bly, who I believe was the navigator with Captain James Cook. And William Bly, of course, later on became fairly well known as the infamous Captain Bly on the HMS Bounty. In 1910, a passenger steamship, the Olympia, grounded on this same Bly Island Reef. It stayed there for about 12 years, I believe, and served as fair warning to people to stay away. You could see it easily. I understand also on nice afternoons, people went there and had tea parties. In 1964, as most of you will know, on Good Friday, 25 years ago approximately, the Great Alaska Earthquake had its epicenter in Prince William Sound. And the city of Valdez, the old city of Valdez, was leveled. This is all new stuff here now. In the early 1970s, and more to the point, fishermen represented by the Cordova District Fishermen United filed suit to prevent oil companies from locating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline system terminus in Valdez. Fishermen believe Prince William Sound to be too valuable a natural resource, an ecosystem, to risk the certainty of oil spills in this area. We wanted to protect our home and our livelihood, so fishermen instead favored an overland route across Canada into the lower 48. We believe that was environmentally much safer. The battle eventually climaxed in the United States Senate when 50 senators voted for the Canadian overland route and 50 voted for the marine terminus here in Valdez. And in the case of a tie, the vice president steps in, and it was President Richard Nixon's Vice President Spiro Agnew who cast the deciding vote to have the pipeline come to Valdez. In my mind, if we need a scapegoat, Spiro will do. Thank you, Mr. Agnew, for this oil disaster. And also for offering eternal proof of the value of one vote. After the vote, the oil companies began construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. It was completed in 1977, and oil from the North Slope began to flow to Valdez, where it was transferred to supertankers and shipped to West Coast refineries, or, this is the fun part for me, sometimes it also continues on down to Panama. It's offloaded from the tanker, piped across Panama, put on a new tanker, and taken up to East Coast refineries. With this present oil transport system, we must live with the potential and reality of oil spills anywhere along the North American coast, from Alaska to Panama up to New England. So we got most of North America's coast covered here. To return to the chronology, excuse me, when the fishing industry reluctantly withdrew from our fight to stop the creation of the terminal site here in Valdez, we were promised three important things by Congress. One, a state-of-the-art vessel traffic system in Prince William Sound. Number two, a state-of-the-art ballast water treatment system at the terminal here in Valdez. And number three, a state-of-the-art oil spill response system. It's pretty obvious from what's happened that we've had none of those. Here are the problems. Number one, a supertanker has grounded on Bligh Island Reef while still in control of the vessel traffic system. Number two, we have an extensive body of information, and we're happy to document for anybody that wants to dig this deeper, an extensive body of information on the many serious flaws in the operation of the ballast water treatment facility here at the Valley's terminal. And number three, and probably most importantly, test drills of the oil spill response team have shown us long before this accident that their response capabilities were pathetic. The fishermen knew, the governmental agencies knew, Alyeska knew, and Alyeska's seven parent companies knew that there never has been an adequate oil spill response capability in Prince William Sound. Quite simply, we believe the oil industry must not be allowed to continue operating with such disregard for the environment and the welfare of citizens of the United States. To end our chronology, now it's spring 1989. On Good Friday, we had the anniversary of the earthquake, and we felt new tremors in us from the oil spill here. Fishermen predicted this scenario almost 20 years ago, and I hope we can predict that 20 years from now, our children won't have to face another oil spill like this. Thank you very much.
David Grimes, a commercial fisherman from Cordova. Now the next speaker is coming to the podium.
My name is Doris Lopez, and my husband and I own two limited entry permits in the Prince William Sound, a purse seine and a drift gillnet permit. And if you'll permit me, I'm going to read because I'm a writer and definitely not a public speaker. Not to detract from the seriousness of this spill, I would like to focus for a moment on an ongoing concern of many residents of the Prince William Sound about continuous neglect and contamination by the Alyeska terminal. And though this may lack the sensationalism of a disaster such as the Exxon Valdez spill, it does not lack seriousness to those of us whose livelihoods depend on this environment. I am not an expert by far, but I have been studying the basic areas of neglect by the Alyeska terminal, and I would like to present three to you for further thought. To begin with, I would like to relate the seriousness of this neglect to the present situation. According to a top Coast Guard official last night, the inadequate crude oil storage facilities at Alyeska will definitely be forcing the allowance of tankers back into the port of Valdez much sooner than is advisable. If Alyeska's facility were up to the standards which were designated and agreed upon at its approval for the present throughput, these decisions could be made according to the safety of our environment, rather than out of a need to accommodate the oil industry's neglect. Other areas of major concern to us are the ballast water treatment and the settling ponds. At the present throughput, 5 ballast water or 90 tanks are required to sufficiently regulate the volume of ballast water through the plant. Alyeska has only 3. In reference to the settling ponds, many of our local laborers worked last year to supposedly clean up sludge which was underneath the ponds due to leakage in the bottoms of them and repair them. They may have been adequately repaired. However, until three weeks ago, I had in my possession a baggie of the sludge and gravel that was buried underneath the settling ponds. We have great concern about the volume of this contamination that may be traveling down through the ground and into the sediment at the bottom of the bay, which could have far-reaching effects in our entire ecosystem. Unfortunately, not foreseeing that this disaster was so up and coming, I disposed of that because it had been sitting on my kitchen counter for 3 months. I do acknowledge the seriousness of the present spill, and there have been many unanswered questions that we are still focusing on, but it is becoming obvious that response and positive action in this situation is very limited. I would like to suggest directing equal effort toward positive action that can be taken to protect our ecosystem and our industry in the future. Thank you.
Doris Lopez, fisherman who she and her husband have a Purse Seine and Drift gillnet permit, and now Ricky Ott is coming. Dr. Ricky Ott is coming to the podium.
My name is Ricky Ott, and I'm the Habitat Chairman of United Fishermen of Alaska. I'm also on the board of directors of Cordova District Fishermen United. I've been involved with specifically the ballast water treatment facility and the insufficiencies at Alyeska Terminal for over a year and a half now. However, what I'm going to talk to you about now is this immediate oil spill.
Ricky, what's your PhD?
I have a master's in oil pollution and a PhD in sediment pollution. I was a marine toxicologist. PhD I got from the University of Washington in 1986. The same year I bought a limited entry permit. I might add that the reason I made this switch is because I was very disillusioned with the amount of information that scientists knew, but how little of that got out to the public. So this is why I'm into explaining things to people. What I'm going to compare now is an oil spill and then the same oil spill with dispersants applied to it and the effects in the ecosystem. Okay. The important thing to remember is that spilled oil does not disappear. It goes into different compartments. This is the air-water interface. These red magnets up here are oil droplets, if you will. The compartments that the spilled oil goes into are the air, the water column, the sediment, and the marine organisms. Okay, so here we have our oil spill. The animals that are immediately put at risk are the animals which use the air-water interface, the marine mammals and the seabirds, because they dive repeatedly through this layer and get coated with oil. What's also happening is this oil is, the lighter compounds are evaporating and going up into the air, and they're being carried away. Okay? In addition, this is like if you gas your car up at the gas station, you smell those fumes, that's what's going on. Oil is composed of many different hydrocarbons. The lighter ones evaporate. In addition, some of these hydrocarbons are going down into the water column. Now this spill essentially sat in the same place for 2 days at least, probably closer to three. So there was actually transfer going into the air and into the water column. When this stuff gets in the water column, these hydrocarbons, they're available to the organisms. The zooplankton, which is, this, we have to pretend this is kind of a microscope here, take up these hydrocarbons, and either then these plankton are eaten by the fish, so now the hydrocarbons are in the fish. Marine mammals can eat the fish and they're transferred into the marine mammals. Or, alternatively, they can go through the zooplankton and be deposited in the bottom sediments. Now they're available to the organisms in the bottom sediments. That's how, this is a process whereby oil at the surface reaches the bottom sediments. It works through the plankton, and also it kind of rains down. When it reaches the bottom sediments, we also have a transfer process that's taken up in bivalves. Sea otters will dive down and get the bivalves. It's picked up by clams, bottom fish, and also the infauna, the animals which live within the sediment. These animals are fed upon by seabirds and also by fish. Okay, so that's kind of the scenario of how oil works into its way into the food web. What happens with dispersed oil? Okay, I'm going to move all these hydrocarbons back up here so we get our spill. Okay. When spilled oil is chemically dispersed, the oil rapidly separates into tiny droplets and sinks. Okay, so now, suddenly, no more water on the interface. It's all in the water column. So you've closed the compartment where it's going into the air. It's now all in the water column. Chemically dispersed oil is more acutely toxic to organisms which live within the water column because it is more available. It's there. Suddenly, and all of it is there, as opposed to just little bits of it coming down slowly as the hydrocarbons work into the water column. Suddenly, it's all there. This toxicity is primarily due to the availability of the dispersed oil rather than the toxicity of the dispersants. It's the dispersed oil that's toxic, not the dispersants. Okay. If dispersants were the miracle cure that Alan McKay would lead us to believe, then the use of dispersants would not have been called an emotionally charged issue, as stated by Dave Kennedy yesterday. I have a lot of confidence in the things that Dave Kennedy says. There also wouldn't be the restrictions regarding the use of dispersants. Zone 1, Zone 2, Zone 3, where Zone 3 is for environmentally sensitive areas, and you absolutely do not apply dispersants in a Zone 3. Okay, well, what we've got going right now is there's wind. Okay, well, during a wind situation, there's basically two options now for this oil that was on the surface. It can form a mousse. When it forms a mousse, it's entrained with water, and it no longer, it's basically locked into the form that it's in. And this, the mousse, is where you get your tar balls from. So this mousse could if you will, freeze the oil into the spill, and this stuff will wash. It will wash as a mousse, either out to sea or up on the beaches. It will be really hard to disperse once a mousse is formed, this emulsion. Secondly, the other thing that can happen is it will be no longer necessary to apply dispersants because of the natural action of the wind and waves. Now, the oil industry is probably going to want to apply to the dispersants anyway. They've been pushing oil dispersants from the very beginning. The fishing industry feels that we have been forced into having to use dispersants because of the lack of mechanical cleanup and containment. Dave Kennedy said yesterday that mechanical cleanup and containment and removal were the preferred method of cleanup. The fishing industry feels that we have been forced into the use of dispersants because of the extremely slow and essentially non-existent containment and mechanical removal activities by Exxon and initially Alyeska. Okay. The fishing industry is not opposed to the oil industry, but the oil industry has the potential to devastate the fishing industry. We expect the oil industry to conduct its business with every possible precaution to protect the quality of the water, our fishing grounds. We expect the oil industry to maintain and operate a state-of-the-art terminal with best available technology. We expect a contingency plan that in scope can handle any emergency that comes out of this terminal. Our expectations have not been fulfilled since this terminal began operations. Thank you.
Dr. Ricky Ott of the United Fishermen of Alaska and the Cordova Fisheries District Fishermen United. This is Dave Hammaker broadcasting live from the Valdez Civic Center. There is a press conference by CDFU and UFA.
Good morning. My name is Jim Brown, and I'm a commercial salmon fisherman and a commercial herring spotter pilot. I think it's of paramount importance for everyone assembled here this morning to realize that the commercial fishermen of the Prince William Sound are potentially faced with a total decimation of our 1989 herring and salmon returns, which at this time are estimated to be worth upwards of $85 million. And the people of Cordova, Alaska want to know what Exxon Corporation plans to do about it. And if they don't do something fast, a lot of people, myself included, are going to be run out of business. And if Exxon Corporation doesn't address its potential decimation of salmon and herring stocks returning to the Prince William Sound, we're not going to see some of these fish return until after the year 2000. And some of these wild pink salmon runs may never be seen again in the Prince William Sound as we know it. Thousands of townspeople from Cordova, Alaska are facing an oil spill of potential unprecedented biological impact. These immediate short-term effects, we're predicting dramatic quantifiable long-term effects for the next 15 to 20 years and quite possibly longer. It's inconceivable that Exxon should or will even consider refusal to compensate us for our potential immediate lost fishing time due to biological contamination or even a tainted level of quality. And already we have reports from both domestic and foreign buyers that they're not interested in producing Prince William Sound seafood products this year. Our worldwide reputation as a seafood producer from our pristine waters of our fjords and inlets was that of the finest quality in the world. Now that reputation has been and will continue to be drugged through an Exxon oil spill. It will take years for our name to recover in the marketplace. Several thousand, up to 6,000 people of Cordova, Alaska, who depend on the Prince William Sound to feed their families and clothe their children, have a question for Exxon Corporation, which is one of the largest corporations in the world. Does the severity of the Exxon oil spill run deep enough to take full responsibility for the opportunity cost to the fishermen of the Prince William Sound, as well as the rejuvenation of its fishing stocks? Will Exxon set right our name in the world seafood market? Will Exxon's sincerity prevail past the year 2000 and into the next century? Because if Exxon does not, the commercial fishermen of the Prince William Sound will pack up and go home. But there won't be any home to go to, because the last person out of Cordova will have turned out the lights. Now let me say a few things from the heart. I came to Cordova many years ago, and I was greatly encouraged by the future of these fisheries. The Prince William Sound fishermen have single-handedly conceived, built, and are paying for the largest fish hatchery program in the world. It's almost as if this Exxon oil spill were planned. We've got millions and millions of fry pouring out of our wild stock streams and out of our hatcheries. And the entire fish population of the Prince William Sound potentially faces biological annihilation at this point. There are a few things in this world that I enjoy doing as much as sitting on my boat and watching my net smoke with fish, and sit there and crack crab and eat it from the pots that I pulled, and look over my right shoulder and look at Mama Brown Bear and her cub ambling down the beach, and look over my other shoulder and see a pod of killer whales ambling up the fjord. And where I fish in the summer, I can see 18 glaciers at any one time. Needless to say, this has been a fall from innocence for the people of Cordova, Alaska. This is a pristine body of water, one of the finest and most untouched ecological areas on this planet. And as we know it, it may never be the same again. The compensation that Exxon has faced could run into millions and millions, hundreds of millions of dollars. It doesn't take a team of experts to add these simple figures together. They should have been ready for this inevitable instance. Mother Nature even provided them with days back to back where they had prime conditions, easiest conditions you can ever find to clean up an oil spill. And they were not ready to immediately respond to the largest oil spill in the history of this country. They should have had people that were ready and willing and trained, and their equipment should not have been scattered everywhere from San Francisco to London. I'm greatly distressed, and I don't know what kind of encouraging news I'll be able to take back to Cordova with me. That's all I have to say.
Jim Brown, a commercial fisherman and a commercial fish spotter from Cordova. This is a broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center. The next speaker is approaching the podium now. This is a press conference again by CDFU and UFA.
Good morning. Thank you for being here. My name is Theo Matthews. I'm a commercial fisherman from Cook Inlet.
I've been asked to speak to you briefly as president of the United Fishermen of Alaska. I think the intent here would be to put a slightly broader perspective on the issue here, considering some state and federal issues. The United Fishermen of Alaska is an umbrella organization. We represent 23 other fishing organizations statewide. They range from Ketchikan to the Bering Sea. We're probably the largest such organization in the United States. We are active on the state and federal level, representing these groups. Our office is located in Juneau. Oil from this Valdez terminal has already greatly impacted our member organizations in Cook Inlet. This occurred with the Glacier Base Spill of 1987. Right now, we're facing a much larger spill that has much greater potential for longer lasting impacts in Prince William Sound. And we feel that every organization that's a member state in Southeast Alaska is at risk every time a tanker leaves this terminal and heads south. I've been asked to come to Valdez by our local organizations to help them coordinate with state and federal agencies and use our good offices in that respect. And I hope we've been able to help them to date. I've been asked to make some observations, take them back to the Executive Committee of the UFA, and these are basically the things I've been asked to take back. As you've heard, the local organizations are absolutely, I can use better adjective, but they are very dissatisfied with the slow response time on this spill. They are very dissatisfied with the amount of response equipment on hand. And they are very dissatisfied with the contingency plan and the manner in which it was put into operation. Local organizations have requested the UFA to investigate four scenarios or situations. The reason the tankers were allowed to run at night, evidently there's some question with variances that have been granted by the Coast Guard that perhaps should not have been granted. They would like us to investigate the Coast Guard traffic monitoring system in the sounds. They strongly urge us to continue our opposition to the federal oil and gas lease in Bristol Bay. And this situation is primarily a classic example of why we oppose that in Bristol Bay. And finally, they want us to review state and federal liability legislation. There are many issues before the Congress right now, and there are perhaps issues that we should bring up soon to the state government. That's all I have for this morning. I'll keep it brief so these people can comment on the local situation. Thank you.
Theo Matthews, president of the UFA and Fishermen of Alaska. Now, Ray Cesarini of Seahawk Seafoods of Valdez.
Ray Cesarini. I'm a local seafood processor. My wife and I own a corporation here in Valdez called Seahawk Seafoods. We're the only, at this time in Valdez, the only year-round processor. We don't close the doors and go anywhere else. We stay here year-round. Well, you've heard the impact of the fishermen themselves, 60, 70, 80, 90 million dollars in losses. How that relates to other people out here that are involved in the Prince William Sound, such as processors, tendermen, employment, a lot of support personnel. You have in the Prince William Sound area a minimum of about 10 processors, whether they're floating or on the beach. Then that number can go as high as 20 to 25. Gross sales of salmon product out here, I would say very conservatively, would range from about $140 million, which some of that money, of course, is used to pay the fishermen, pay the labor, things like this, to as high as about $250 million, just depending on the size of the run. So you see now, as we're talking, how these numbers can grow. There's more to it than just catching the fish. Employment in the Prince William Sound in the fishing industry, exclusive of the fishing boats themselves, probably 5,000 to 6,000 people annually make their living from working in fish processing plants. The environment here is, it's a hardy country, but the environment has always been fragile, and we've always been fairly aware of that. As far as marketing, we're already getting feedback from our markets worldwide, Europe, the lower 48, Japan. We don't deal with the Koreans, but I'm sure they're concerned also about the quality of the product that will be coming out of Prince William Sound this year, and if it will be coming out of Prince William Sound this year. This is a question that nobody can answer at this time because of the, you know, the movement of the fish, the salmon fry, the herring oil on the beaches. Nobody really knows the impact. You know, we could be looking at an impact that will last 15 to 20 years in this industry. But we've had a lot of really concerned customers, you know, with the consumption of fish, which the state of Alaska and everybody in the country has been pushing. Fish is a good food, it's better for you. You know, there's the world demand for seafood has grown, even in Alaska in the last few years. In the United States, it's gone from about 8 or 9 pounds per annum. Now they're up to pushing almost 15 pounds per annum, just domestic. And a lot of this fish has come, of course, from Alaska, and a great deal of it has come from Prince William Sound. This year, we predicted the largest salmon run in the history of record for Prince William Sound. In the entire state of Alaska, and I'm talking about pink salmon, which is our primary resource here. This has nothing to do with other fisheries, and there are many other fisheries. We were looking at the possibility of a 40 million fish catch, which was actually half of the entire pink salmon catch for the state of Alaska. And we may not be able to sell it. We have been impacted here in Valdez already, Seahawk Seafoods, of course, because they've closed the port and we weren't allowed to bring any fishing vessels in or out. So we've been impacted already. I don't know how other people, if other people have been, but we have personally been impacted at this time. The reaction to the spill, I can't believe that people have stood up here and said how happy they've been about the reaction to the oil spill. I flew out personally with a local pilot, Chuck LePage. I flew from 2 o'clock Friday afternoon until approximately 2:45 before we came back to town, and just nothing had been done. I mean, that was 14 hours after the incident, and the oil was very visible. I can't believe that they couldn't have at least put something around the trailing edge. I know there were literally hundreds of fishermen that were willing to jump right out there and help them because they had a barge broke down. Their reaction time in an emergency situation like that had to be about 1 mile an hour. Thank you.
Ray Sassarini of Seahawk Seafoods, and now Jack Lamb of CDFU is returning to the podium. This is a live broadcast from the Valdez Civic Center Ballroom.
This talks and things obviously have become long. I think that also helps to demonstrate the magnitude of the impact that this has upon the livelihoods of the people that live in Prince William Sound, every portion of it and from every aspect of it. At this time, if you do have any questions, we'd be more than happy to field the questions. Would also like to say that even though what you've heard up here is what the impact is upon our industry, and it is real, that we still have to remain hopeful because it is our livelihood. We have to hope and pray that something good can come out of this yet, and we still stand ready to assist in any possible way that we can. I'd like to make one last brief statement. That is that the fishing industry in Prince William Sound is not the enemy here. The fishing industry is not the threat. The fishing industry is here to help. Our product does not threaten any other product unless our product is contaminated by some outside source. And with that, I'll open the floor to questions if anybody has any. Thank you.
Question for Ricky. I'm wondering, at this point, is there any practical alternative to dispersants, or as Exxon said, are they out of options and they have to use them now?
They are out of options, but mechanical cleanup and recovery should still be used along the beaches, because those are Zone 3, and there's still a decision to be made, depending on what the wind does, what to do in a Zone 2 situation. Zone 1 dispersants are allowed. It's a deeper water, there's more mixing, and dispersed oil is more likely to be advected out of the area. Zone 2, you're in kind of a marginal area. On-scene coordinator makes a decision, and we hope to be in on that decision. Fish and Game has informed us that if that decision is to be made, they will immediately contact us, which is the first indication that we've had of anyone asking us for our opinion.
Ricky, you were saying before that, you know, you don't like the use of dispersants, but are you now saying, yes, you agree that they should use them because there's no other alternative?
If the wind, there's a wind window that's optimal for dispersants. If it's above that wind window, we would probably be happy with natural dispersion at this point. So as not to add to the problem of putting the dispersed oil into the water. I mean, just
last night Exxon seemed to be saying that there's no way that mechanical collection is going to work because it's just too big right now, and they seem to be suggesting that dispersants is the only practical way to go.
In the main open area, that's true, but still there's got to be mechanical efforts and containment along the beaches, because dispersants are not to be allowed in Zone 3, and all the beaches are Zone 3.
So you're saying that the thing to do now is to mechanically protect the beaches, but otherwise do nothing?
Otherwise, I'm not sure exactly how much the wind is blowing. I would defer to Dave Kennedy's decision. I have a lot of confidence in what he says.
What's your understanding of what the wind window is?
I believe it's from about 15 to 25, I believe. 25
above 25.
Above 25, the natural dispersion is probably as great as it would be with the dispersants, so why apply the dispersants? Also, there's a regulation, and the regional response, again, Dave Kennedy might know what this regulation is. I do know that there's a maximum of 20 gallons per acre allowed in the state of Alaska, 20 gallons of dispersants per acre. I was trying to figure acres to square miles, but not having too much luck. In the lower 48, it's 10. Up here, I think it's a little bit more because of the cold water.
Jack? The governor asked Denny Kelso yesterday to go to the regional response team and ask for a takeover of the spill from Exxon. There were meetings between the Coast Guard and DEC and Exxon yesterday afternoon. The result was kind of a joint agreement. Later, the state announced they were going to try and recruit you fishermen to help deploy a bunch of booms that were going to get shipped up from Seattle. What's the progress on that?
At this particular point, the progress with that, and so far as our organization is concerned, I have had no word that we've been contacted to assist in that particular manner from Cordova and with the fishermen that we organized. However, I do understand that several of the fishing vessels in Valdez have been employed at this particular time with the ongoing process with the booms, and I'm not going to venture to what extent that is, but I'm sure that there are additional vessels in the area here that can be utilized, and as we've stated before, there are a large number of vessels in Cordova ready, willing, and able. Just as a point of interest, the DEC has asked for 4 of our vessels to assist in their efforts from a scientific standpoint, and they are already on scene. They were asked yesterday at midday, and they're on scene.
Is there anybody else that can offer any more comment on that?
I received calls this morning from the various stations that they've set up around town asking for vessels. We have vessels in repair that we're trying to get out there, but I basically believe they've come to the end of their resource here in Valdez. They're begging for boats that they were told yesterday would not be ready until tonight. And they've called me all morning and said, is your boat ready? When can it be ready? They need more boats. I'm not sure why they haven't contacted Cordova yet, but they have run out of resources here as far as I know.
How many boats are available in Valdez? Do
you mean ready to go right now? Yeah, well, I'm not sure how many have been sent out. I would say probably, oh, this is a guess, 15 maybe? 2 days, well, the morning after it happened, at 6:30 in the morning, my husband along with, do you want me to stand up here? My husband along with many other fishermen was up and had our vessels ready to go. To refute what the gentleman from Alyeska said here a couple of days ago, we made calls all day long. I got shuffled. I got, I don't know what we're going to do. I got wait, and I got, we'll call you. My husband was sent out the next day. I was told he was one of only two vessels out the following day, which would have been Saturday. So yesterday was the time when a larger number of vessels was sent out to begin booming. And when I spoke to a gentleman who's been in charge of sending them out this morning, now I've been told that because the winds have come up, many of them have had to go and anchor in bays because the waters are just too rough for them to be trying to haul the booming around.
A question for Jack. Not be allowing those tankers that are waiting offshore to come in and board with fresh oil? And if so, how long should they be delayed?
Answer that ultimately, but I think that you'll find that from the perspective of the fishermen in general, that they don't want to see the tankers moving in here at all until that lane is clear, period. They don't want to see that spill disturbed in any way, shape, or form by any vessels going through it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the oil industry has, once again, put themselves in a position where actions have to be taken that, forced actions. They put us again in a no other option situation. They are literally running out of storage room to put the oil that comes down the pipeline at the terminal. There's nowhere else to put the oil. They've run out of crude oil storage tanks, or they are running out of crude oil storage tanks. Shutting down the pipeline, I understand, is not a very desirable option. I mean, there's 12 pump stations all up and down the thing, and the system's pressurized, and it would be a big mess. I think they're going to have to bring in tankers. They've been using the tankers as crude oil storage tanks. They're going to have to bring them in, not because the nation needs the oil immediately, but more like because they are running out of space to store the oil. Congress approved their design way before the terminal was built. I have design plans of Alyeska facility, and I'll be happy to explain after this is over with problems at the terminal. But it's because they're running out of storage space. And I think that they should be allowed to bring the tankers in. As opposed to closing down the pipeline.
Is the danger to the fry that are leaving, is it the danger that they'll be contaminated or that they'll be killed? What is the
danger to the fry is that they'll be killed. The herring, the danger there is that the hydrocarbons will be picked up by the fish and deposited in the eggs. And so that will make the roe unmarketable or tainted.
Ray, I want to get some comments on the black cod opening that's coming up. What importance that is to your business.
Well, there's several fisheries coming online, actually April 1st, which is in normal course of events, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game will open the Sacro herring fishery in Prince William Sound on April 1st. Then they will close it by emergency order and start gauging the fish until the fish reach an optimum egg yield. And as this process continues, it's sort of a countdown situation, very similar to what they do in the rest of the state, Sitka. Some of you are familiar with that. Black cod season opens the basically the 1st of April also. And the problem we've had is we can't seem to, we've been told, and I brought it up last night. I've called the Coast Guard every day since Friday. And I've been told that no vessels other than vessels they want to are going to get in and out of port. So I don't know if what the impact will be. We have several boats in the harbor that have not gone out on this oil spill because they want to fish. You know, some people are afraid of contaminating their vessels if they do go out. You know, they've been working for years to upgrade fishing vessels in Prince William Sound, so they do have this quality situation, more so than other places. The fishermen have worked very hard. They've made huge investments, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to have a particularly nice type of vessel. So some people don't want to go out and use them for this oil thing because they're afraid of contamination, contaminating their fish holes, things like this. You know, oil and fish just don't mix. There's no two ways about it. I don't know what'll happen on the black cod opening. That's usually done in the Gulf of Alaska. But last night I'd asked the question and I was told, well, if you just get everybody gathered up, we'll escort them in. Well, fishing doesn't work that way. You know, it's dependent on weather, people, you know, people load up boats faster than other people, things like this. You know what? And a fisherman's not going to wait for an Armada to come into Valdez and sell a fish when they can go to Cordova, Whittier, Seward, you know. So I guess effectively we're out of business until they can start transiting the port again.
I think, Dr. Art, you were the one to ask this. What about this business of burning?
I'm sorry.
What about this business of burning the oil off? Apparently they're still testing.
It's going to create air quality problems, but I think that would be better than having the oil remain in the water. At this point, it's sort of grasping at straws, any way to get the oil out of the water. And with the wind right now, if it was in the air, it would be dispersed fairly rapidly. It needs to be a certain thickness, and I think that with this wind, it also needs to be in patches where it could be contained together. They call them fire booms. There's also these bombs that they've been talking about, but it needs to be covering a surface area that's large enough and a certain thickness to effectively burn.
In small isolated pockets, that from what I understand, it's not something that would really be effective for a large amount of oil. Is that correct?
Actually, I'm not sure, but I think it's more effective in a large amount of oil where you could just burn the whole area and get it out.
Ricky, what about liability claims? Any of the fishermen filed and any estimates so far on, as you're saying, opportunity loss? Anybody filing?
No, there's been no monetary discussion so far. What we have presented to the claims section of Exxon is that what we're looking at is damages. We're looking at both short-term and long-term damages, what we suggest and expect them to do to compensate us, and we're just sort of just so far talking programs and
something on the order of figures of income in past years, or would that be
what we're telling you is the 10-year average and then values from this year.
Which would be approximately?
The herring fishery, I believe, is estimated value of $15 million this year, the sacro fishery.
The total through this, I mean, this goes on, affects all the other seasons.
I'm not, does anybody know what the salmon, I know what the forecast is, but I don't know what the...
I think that a conservative estimate of the total value of the fisheries in Prince William Sound, should it not take place, worst case scenario at all, would easily exceed $100 million ex vessel value. And again, if you might recall what Mr. Cesarini said in regards to processing, how the numbers begin to go up, that directly relates back to the processors and right on down through the industry.
Further question for Ms. Lopez. Just wondering how many storage tanks were originally promised at Valdez and how many they actually have.
We are supposed to have 32. They are supposed to have 32 storage tanks. They have 18. I spoke with my mother this morning. She took a class that was offered by LASCA at one time, and she was told in that class that at present throughput, with the storage they have, if they did not slow down throughput, they could only store the oil for 2 days. That's why they've had to slow the oil down so much.
Do you know at what rate it's flowing now? Has anybody told you? At what rate? Is it still 800,000?
That's the last report we've received at all.
Jack, I have a question. Do you know what is being done as of right now on the oil cleanup? It seems like we're not getting anything done but press conference. And I think it's time that these organizations got together and got something done, got something moving. If it's nothing more than sending people out there and wiping oil off the beach, I think it needs to be started. It's sad to sit here and watch this disperse out over Prince William Sound as the weather and the winds and the tide carry it. We're just getting further and further behind. I think it's time these organizations got together and got something done.
That's our goal, to get everybody working together. I can't really expound on your request, Lloyd. Again, for those of the media that are here, the gentleman who just spoke is another one of the members of the community of Prince William Sound whose livelihood's in danger.
All chemical burning.
That comment was just say no to all chemical burning, and I think that was the voice of one of the natives of the community.
What happens if the wind switches after it dumped it? It happened just the other day. All the people in the village got sick. Headaches. Now you're talking about dropping it again. Who's responsible for the sickness there? Who's responsible for evacuating them?
Exxon should be, but I just want to say regarding that village, if there's any pregnant women in that village, they should be gotten out.
We're talking about fish. You guys are talking about fish. We're talking about human life down there.
I hope that the news media is able to pick up the comments that are being made by this individual back here. He's from the village of Tetitlik, which is absolutely adjacent to the spill site out there. And what he's saying is that the burn that took place the other night, the residue of the smoke and so forth, made the people in the village sick. They don't know to what extent, and they're wanting to know who's responsible for it. They're asking that no more burns be allowed because of the danger to the village and the human life in the village.
Who authorized the burns to start? Which department? That's what I'd like to know.
The Coast Guard makes the final decision on those type of things.
Help with that. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation, and they have to apply for an approval for that burn for this, a specified length of time. We have put stipulations in any approval for that the village of Tetitlik must be contacted, the winds have to be a certain direction, no populations can be impacted. There has to be some prior work done before they will actually do any further burning. The village of Tetitlik will have some say in it.
Have they been given permission to burn today?
They were still drafting the approval up. I'm not sure what the times or the dates that are on it. They also have to give us daily burn plans, and everything is monitored. Any shift in the wind, any impact at all that's unexpected, they stop immediately. That's the way approvals work for open burns. And we'll have a copy of that as soon as it's made available to the company.
At this point, it seems that we're asking to do an awful lot of speculation on things that are taking place in the oil industry. And I would like, you know, if there are any last questions pertaining to the fisheries involvement or the fisheries impact on this, we'll field those questions. If not, then we will bring this to a close at this time. And I do believe that there's a Coast Guard conference set for 9:00, which we're into that a little bit for them. So unless someone has a specific question, we'll bring this to a close, and thank you very much.
Jack Lamb, the vice president of CDFU, is closing off this portion of the conference. Right at the end of the conference, four gentlemen from the village of Tetitlik have arrived and were relating experiences. Evidently, there has been a negative impact on the village of Tetitlik by the first experiments with conducting the open burn. Reporting from Tetitlik, the gentlemen were saying that after the burn, there were people getting sick. And they were wondering, you know, how they're going to handle getting people out of the village, how they're going to handle impact there. A spokeswoman for DEC said that in the future, any burns that are permitted will be done only with the prior notice to the community of Tetitlik, and only when wind conditions would prevent smoke and airborne residue from arriving at the village. We heard today at this press conference from Jack Lamb of CDFU, David Grimes, who's a commercial fisherman for herring and salmon from Cordova, Doris Lopez, who is a commercial fisherman based in Valdez. She and her husband have permits for purse seine and drift gillnet. Dr. Ricky Ott, who's the habitat chairman for UFA, Jim Brown, a commercial fisherman and commercial fish spotter, Theo Matthews, who's the president of UFA, United Fishermen of Alaska, and Ray Cesarini, who's the president and owner of Seahawk Seafoods of Valdez. We are anticipating the Coast Guard will be before 2 months.